Men, if you're ready to reclaim your edge, listen up. I used to be held back by constant bathroom trips, with multiple wake-ups during my sleep and looking for restrooms whenever I was out. Then I discovered Better Man. After just 2 months, I started experiencing fewer trips to the bathroom, less urge to go, and I even slept through some nights. I feel a noticeable boost in my overall well-being, even sexual stamina. It gives me the freedom and confidence to live life on my terms. Better Man is clinically tested and trusted by thousands of men over 25 years. Ready to take back control? Go to BeBetterNow.com to order your supply today. That's BeBetterNow.com.
These statements have not been evaluated by the FDA. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. Use as directed. Individual results may vary.
That's kind of competition between the soul. That's competition between the soul and the mind.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison. And as usual, we are excited to bring you the news. But before we do, I wanted to take this opportunity to thank you all for listening. We're coming up on, Derek, I can't believe it, our fourth year of doing this. And it's been a really great experience for me. I'm really proud of the community that we've built, of people who take a more critical approach to U.S. foreign relations and international affairs than you find in most mainstream media sources. So Derek and I just wanted to take the opportunity to thank you all for listening. And for those of you who haven't yet subscribed to the podcast, to ask you to please consider subscribing. This show really does take a lot of work. We do it for hours a week. We've also got a lot of cool little shows coming up that we're excited to announce. So if you haven't yet, please consider taking a moment to subscribe to the podcast. This week, we've actually got a really interesting episode with Vincent Bevins. In the coming weeks, we'll have episodes on China, the future of history with Mike Duncan, and a lot of really cool things. So please consider subscribing. And if you haven't yet reviewed us on Apple Podcasts, as I asked last week, please consider doing that as well. It doesn't take that much time, and it really does help get the show out there. It alerts other people to us and good things like that. So I just want to take that opportunity to thank you and to ask you for what we call in the podcast biz, a call to action. We'd really appreciate it. So Derek, why don't you tell us about this U.S. Houthi ceasefire?
So this was announced by the Omani government on Tuesday. Oman has been brokering, apparently, negotiations, back channel negotiations between the U.S. and the Houthis. I should note it was actually blurted out by Donald Trump the previous day as he was meeting in the Oval Office with Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney, where he basically declared to a stunned room of reporters who hadn't heard anything about it that the Houthis had capitulated to the United States, that they had essentially begged the U.S. to stop firing on northern Yemen. And he was going to do it because he's a good guy and they had agreed to, you know, stop doing whatever it was that they were doing. I'm not sure he's even aware of why he's bombing Yemen or has been. But yes, the Omani government then announced on Tuesday that there was a deal in place to basically end. The parameters of this seem very basic to me. The Houthis have agreed to stop attacking U.S. ships. I'm not sure if that extends to commercial shipping or just U.S. warships. And the Trump administration has agreed to stop bombing northern Yemen. The Houthis made it very clear, contra Trump's capitulation talk, they made it very clear that they are not going to stop attacking Israel. They've been, of course, as we've covered on the show, firing missiles at Israel. They even say they're going to continue to attack commercial ships in the Red Sea that they claim have ties to Israel, which is how all of this, how we got into this in the first place, because they keep attacking commercial ships that they claim are either going to or coming from Israel. And sometimes the captains of those ships or the owners of those ships say they don't have anything to do with Israel, but the Houthis claim they do anyway. And so, that's brought the U.S. into it, brought the U.S. into the region. The Trump administration, of course, restarted the Joe Biden eternal war on Yemen. But they're still going to do that. So I don't know what this actually means in terms of commercial shipping in the Red Sea, or whether even shipping companies are going to be more willing to go through the Red Sea under these circumstances than they have been. There's been a noticeable curtailment in Red Sea shipping activity because of the Houthi activities. So I don't really know what the effect of this is going to be, except that maybe the U.S. Navy will get to pull at least one of its aircraft carriers out of the region. And those ships that remain won't be under threat of being attacked by the Houthis for however long this deal lasts. But again, doesn't seem like much of a capitulation, given that the Houthis say they're going to continue doing pretty much all of the things that they've been doing prior to the U.S. getting involved. So Trump, you know, claiming victory here, maybe just seeing an opportunity to declare victory and get out of a policy that hasn't accomplished anything. Again, the Houthis are still doing everything that they were doing. The U.S. hasn't really deterred them or degraded them. It has spent an awful lot of money and lost an awful lot of materiel in the Red Sea to accomplish very little other than killing Yemeni civilians and maybe impacting Yemeni humanitarian assistance. So I suspect this was just a window for Trump to quit. He was even asked, I believe, by reporters, not Tuesday, but subsequently, like, what are you going to do if the Houthis continue to attack Israel after this, you know, after you've got into the ceasefire? And he basically said he's okay with that. It's not really his problem. So I guess this is just going to continue the way it has been. But the U.S. will not be bombing northern Yemen anymore, which presumably is a good thing. We'll see how long it lasts. There's some speculation that this is a short term thing. Trump is supposed to go to the Persian Gulf next week. He may just be looking to sort of clear the decks as he does that. He's also, of course, engaged or said his administration is engaged in nuclear negotiations with Iran, and, you know, easing tensions with the Houthis temporarily could help usher those negotiations along a little bit. So who knows?
Derek, this is how I know you've never read The Art of the Deal, because what you don't understand is that you can make a deal with yourself. And so that's what Trump is doing.
He's making a deal.
He doesn't need another
party.
That's
your toughest negotiator is yourself. That's the hardest
that's how I live
negotiating
my life.
Opponent you're ever going to face is you, yourself. And Trump has overcome himself to make a deal to stop doing what he was doing.
This is exactly like when Link fought Shadow Link in The Legend of Zelda 2. let's move on to the very, very grim topic, which is Israel. The Israeli government has released its plans for Gaza, and it's about what one would expect at this point, I think.
Right. The Israeli military, the IDF, called up tens of thousands of reservists over the weekend, or began the process of calling up tens of thousands of reservists. They're being, I think, a little bit picky because there's an anticipation that a very large percentage of reservists would refuse to report under these circumstances, and they don't want to get into an embarrassing, potentially debilitating situation with a large number of non-reports. So they're trying to be, I think, a little judicious about this. But they are calling up reservists mostly to go, I think, to the West Bank so that they can bring active duty troops from the West Bank to Gaza to bolster what is supposed to be a major expansion of the Gaza operation. Now, there are some details that have come out this week. They've been talking about this for a couple of weeks. Over the weekend, the Israeli security cabinet, I believe the full cabinet as well, approved this planned expansion of the Gaza operation. It's being called Operation Gideon's Chariots. And basically, it sounds like more and more intense version of what they've been doing since the recent truce, 6-week truce, expired in March, and they resumed kind of mid March their activities, their bombing campaign, their seizing of territory, all the things that they've been doing since they resumed activity in the middle of March. The idea is to take and hold territory, not to just clear it or try to clear it of Hamas fighters, but to actually occupy it along the security axes that they've already created in Gaza, but to expand those gradually, flattening buildings, just kind of decimating what is already a very decimated territory, and of course, hurting the entire presumably or potentially civilian population, anyone who is able or willing to go, civilian population of Gaza into a single zone in what used to be Rafah. I hesitate to even call it Rafah at this point. It's been so, kind of decimated. But the Israelis have cut that area off with another one of their security corridors from the rest of Gaza. The idea would be to herd people into that area, get them, in a sense, out of the way. They would declare the rest of Gaza essentially a free fire zone, and anybody remaining would be treated as an enemy combatant and at greater risk of being killed without, you know, worrying about evacuations or, whatever token effort they've made toward protecting civilians. The humanitarian or the relief effort, which the Israelis cut off in early March as the ceasefire, the truce was expiring, could be resumed then in this southern area, southern area that used to be Rafah. There has been more information on that as well. The Washington Post reported earlier this week that basically the plan is to set up 6 distribution hubs in Rafah, that they will bring in, the Israelis will bring in 60 aid trucks per day, which is far below what is required to support the population of the territory. But they would bring them in to these hubs. Each hub would serve about 5,000 to 6,000 households. Again, totally inadequate to the need. But they do suggest that they might expand this program moving forward if it goes well. There would be private military contractors, U.S. private military contractors, i.e. mercenaries, providing security. They would be using facial recognition technology to ensure that the people who come to these distribution hubs to pick up aid are verified somehow to represent represent the households that they live in. It is extremely complicated, excessively complicated. As I say, completely insufficient in its scope. It's been criticized universally by humanitarian groups around the world, as well as some governments, especially in Europe. But this is what the Israelis plan to do. They're going to take over full control, basically, of how aid gets distributed, who gets it, under what conditions they get it, and cut out the United Nations and other organizations relying on these private security contractors and maybe private companies to do the distribution work as well. I'm not sure about that. There's also been talk, Danny, I know you'll appreciate this. There's been talk of the U.S. taking over temporary administration of Gaza along the lines of, this is just brilliant stuff, along the lines of the Coalition Provisional Authority that ran Iraq after we ousted Saddam Hussein in 2003.
The Green Zone had no problems, Terry.
Green Zone was, it was peaceful, quiet. You may remember how well the CPA worked in Iraq. So that kind of model we're going to bring to Gaza, I guess. Those are the details that have come out. It's not a full picture, but it does give you an idea of how dismal things are about to get.
So you already mentioned this, but Trump is planning on visiting the Persian Gulf region, the Middle East, and he has some goals. He has some deals he wants to make. So why don't you tell us about those deals, Derek?
Yeah, he wants to do business deals mostly. He's visiting the rich Gulf states. He's not going to Israel, although the Israeli government is trying to lobby him to make some kind of short stopover during the visit. But he's going to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE. And if you go to Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the UAE on one trip, it's pretty clear why you're there. You're there because they have money and you want some of it. So that's what he's doing. He is reportedly still pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza. And I think the reason is, again, as I speculated with the Houthi situation, he would like this to not be happening while he's in these Arab Gulf capitals talking about, talking deals with all the monarchs. It would make it easier for him if Gaza was at least frozen in place, if not something more substantial than that. So he's still pushing ceasefire proposals. Hamas doesn't seem interested at all at this point. Unsurprisingly, one of its Politburo members, Bassem Naim, told AFP earlier this week that there's no sense in engaging in talks or considering new ceasefire proposals because of the Israeli, what he called the hunger war and the extermination war that the IDF is waging on the people of Gaza. So that seems like a dead end. There is also a report. This was in Israeli media, Jerusalem Post, I believe, that the U.S. is telling the Israeli government that it may move ahead with the long-awaited or long-anticipated deal with Saudi Arabia for the U.S. to provide the Saudis with military, military guarantees, defense protection, potentially nuclear technology, without involving Israel. If you remember from when the Biden administration was desperately trying to do a deal like this with the Saudis, the third piece or the third leg of the triangle involved Israel. Third corner of the triangle, I guess. And the idea was that Israel would put Palestinians on some kind of discernible path towards statehood, allow that to advance to some degree, not all the way to statehood, although the Saudis insist that they'll never do a deal with Israel that doesn't involve full Palestinian statehood. But there was talk of, just making a gesture basically toward Palestinian statehood. And in return, the U.S. would expand the Abraham Accords to include Saudi Arabia. There would be normalized relations between the Saudis and Israel, and the U.S. would give the Saudis a guarantee of military protection. The nuclear thing was sort of on the sidelines of that. The Saudis would like U.S. help in building nuclear power plants and potentially, getting them down the road toward a nuclear weapon, but who knows. But now the talk is that apparently they're threatening the Israelis that they may just go ahead with that, the U.S.-Saudi piece of this without Israel, because the Israelis have shown no willingness to budge at all on Palestinian statehood. And Trump is supposedly getting frustrated with this. And consequently, they'll just do the deal with the Saudis, which has some implications in terms of Saudi Arabia's relationship with China, which the U.S. would like to undercut, certainly. But who knows? I assume there will be some talk of this while Trump is in the region, but I don't know how far they'll get.
Thanks, Derek. Let's also talk about this India-Pakistan clash, the new clashes between them. And if people haven't yet, check out our special that came out a couple of days ago, I think 3 days ago when this airs, where we go into the details of India's response to Pakistan. So Derek, tell us about it.
Right. Without stepping on anything that we talked about in the special, there's more information. I mean, we recorded that, basically right after the attacks, the Indian attacks had happened early Wednesday morning, local time, with the benefit of, a little time to assess what had gone on. It's clear the Indian military struck 9 targets throughout Pakistan. A couple of them in Pakistani Kashmir, some of them in Pakistan's Punjab province. They killed at least 31 people. Several more were wounded. The Pakistani military retaliated that night with heavy, that early that morning, with heavy artillery fire and other kind of fire across the line of control in Kashmir. At least 13 people was the latest figure I've seen killed in India or Indian-controlled Kashmir in that retaliatory fire. And there were reports of a number of Indian fighter jets crashing. Now, the Indian Air Force seems to have basically fired from its planes, but from Indian airspace. So they fired long-range weapons into Pakistan without crossing into Pakistani airspace. Nevertheless, a number of those planes crashed, and the obvious implication is that the Pakistani military shot them down. I don't think the Indians are willing to acknowledge that, but that appears to be what happened. There's been no major large-scale response from Pakistan yet, which I guess is a positive sign. There are possibilities here for both countries to de-escalate at this point. However, there was an exchange of fire overnight between the Indian and Pakistani militaries. Partly this included small arms fire across the line of control in Kashmir, which has become sort of a nightly thing since the Pahalgam terrorist attack last month. So that was, in a sense, just a return to normalcy, or a sort of normal state of the way things are right now. But there were also reports of drone strikes or attempted drone strikes on both sides. Pakistan hitting a number of what they said were Indian military targets. The Indian military firing or launching a number of its drones in response. Many of them, the Pakistanis say, they shot down. One did get close to the city of Lahore. It caused an explosion that I don't think, I'm not sure what the casualty figures are. I think the last I saw was one civilian killed and a number of soldiers wounded, but that may change. So that's a little bit heavier than you would hope, but still not, I think, the sort of full-scale response from Pakistan that could trigger an escalation to war, into, you know, just full-blown declared war. So right now, it seems like things are very tense. Certainly, we are likely to see more of these exchanges of fire, but whether they remain kind of discrete events or funnel into the two countries declaring war on each other and things escalating much more seriously remains to be seen.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about this potential U.S.-China trade talks that might happen.
Yeah, this is, you know, something that the Trump administration has been saying. It's, you know, getting appeals from the Chinese government. Please, please negotiate with us. The Chinese government continually says, no, we're not. We haven't done that. We haven't reached out to the U.S. So Trump, at one point, Donald Trump said he was getting phone calls from Xi Jinping, and the Chinese government said, no, that's not happening. But they are now apparently planning to hold somewhat high level trade talks this weekend. U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent and the Chinese Commerce Ministry both confirmed earlier this week that these talks will take place in Switzerland. Bessent will lead the U.S. delegation. Chinese Vice Premier He Lifeng will lead the Chinese delegation. You know, who knows whether they're going to be able to make any headway. They're effectively embargoing most products on one another at this point. The U.S. has a 145% tariff on most Chinese goods. China has a 125% tariff on most U.S. goods. So they're effectively not trading right now. And the impact of that hasn't really yet been seen, I don't think, in terms of store shelves and just basic, you know, basic things in the United States. But it's coming. You hear these reports, you see these reports of, you know, shipping in the Pacific Ocean basically dropping off a cliff, ports on the west coast of the United States being empty, you know, a lot of things that suggest we're in for a bit of a supply shock at some point if a deal isn't done. Even if it is, there may be a bump in the road. But I certainly would not expect them to come to a full-fledged trade agreement this weekend, given that they haven't really talked yet. But they could lay the groundwork at least for additional negotiations and maybe come away with something that like reduces these tariffs from ridiculous to, you know, high but manageable.
Only semi-ridiculous.
Right. Semi-ridiculous. Exactly.
Only semi-destructive.
Yeah.
So speaking of trade deals, let's talk about this US-UK deal.
Yes. Donald Trump Wednesday night went on his little Truth Social social media outlet and declared that he was going to have a big news conference coming at 10 a.m. Concerning what he called a major trade deal with representatives of a big and highly respected country. He lied about that. It was with the UK. So not really big or highly respected in my opinion. But there is a trade deal in place. Yeah, exactly. There is a deal in place with the UK. Apparently, I don't know any of the details. We're recording this, just a little bit after the announcement was supposed to have been made. And I haven't seen, even any indication of the announcement having been made, let alone anybody reporting on the details of the trade agreement. But, according to Trump, this is the first of many trade deals to come. So, you know, good for him, I guess.
Thanks, Derek. And let's talk about these Australian elections that just happened.
Right. Australia had its federal election on Saturday. You know, without going into too much detail, it turned basically, you know, as Canada's election last week went, according to people's hostility to Donald Trump, basically, supporting the center left liberal party in opposition to Trump and his calls for Canada to become the 51st state. This election also seems to have turned on antipathy toward Donald Trump. The Labour Party, the Australian Labour Party of Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, won pretty handily, surprisingly enough. This is after, for several months, the Conservative opposition, the Liberal National Coalition, was leading in polls. All indications were that Albanese was going to be out of a job and that the Labour Party was going to be back in the minority, back in the opposition. All it took was Donald Trump getting elected, basically, to turn the polls around. I guess the tariffs helped as well. And not only did the Labour Party survive, as the Liberals in Canada did, to form a minority government, the Labour Party actually expanded on its parliamentary majority, gained seats, which is fascinating to me, just in terms of watching the Trump effect play out. Also, as in Canada, where the Conservative Party leader, Pierre Poilievre, lost his own race, presumably for having, ties to, or being, considered too close to Donald Trump. The leader of the Liberal National Coalition also lost his race. In this case, it was Peter Dutton, lost his race. Unlike Poilievre, who managed to convince a member of the Conservative Party in a safe Conservative district to resign, to quit Parliament so that Poilievre could run for that seat and stay in Parliament and retain his position as party leader. I think Dutton is probably on the way out at this point, if he hasn't already been replaced.
All right, let's move on to Sudan, and let's talk about the RSF attacking Port Sudan.
The RSF has been carrying out drone strikes daily since Sunday. They started these on Sunday on Port Sudan, which has become the de facto capital of Sudan's military government. The Sudanese military has its headquarters there. It has its administrative offices. The nominal president, junta leader, whatever you want to call him, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, has his offices in Port Sudan, I guess de facto head of state, if you want to really give him credit for that. And the RSF has, to this point, or had before Sunday, not attacked that city, I think partly because they just didn't have the capabilities in terms of long range drone strike capabilities, or they did have them, but they didn't want to use them, use it up on attacking Port Sudan. But now that they've been kicked out effectively of the Khartoum region by the Sudanese military, or at least mostly kicked out of the Khartoum region, they appear to have adopted a new strategy here, which is more long range strikes specifically against Port Sudan. There has been some damage here. I don't want to overstate the effect of these strikes, but they have damaged the airport. At one point on, I believe, Tuesday, they were able to knock out the main power station for the city of Port Sudan, sending the city into blackout. And more than that, I think the cumulative effect of these strikes happening every day is raising fears about Port Sudan itself, which is the main conduit for humanitarian aid coming into the country. There's some aid that comes in over the land border with Chad, but a lot of it comes in through Port Sudan. And there are concerns about the viability of Port Sudan for that purpose, if it's going to be, coming under these daily drone strikes. So something to be concerned about.
Thank you, Derek. Let's talk about these peace talks in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, which have, in terms of good news, advanced.
That's correct. On Monday, Massad Boulos, who is Donald Trump's senior Africa and Middle East advisor, announced, again, via social media, that the Congolese and Rwandan governments had presented what he called a draft peace proposal. This is the next step in their negotiating process, which has been brokered by the United States. You may recall Marco Rubio met with the foreign ministers of both countries recently. They agreed to, and it was at that meeting that they agreed, they signed sort of statements of intent to produce some sort of draft peace proposal or proposals that could then be synthesized into a deal that should, given the extent of Rwanda's kind of patronage of the M23 militant group that operates in the Eastern DRC, should end that conflict if it comes to fruition. The next step is negotiations over these draft. Bulos called it a peace proposal. I suspect it's more peace proposals. So they'll try to study them. That's what the administration is doing, I believe, studying them to see where the points of agreement, disagreement are. Negotiations will resume later this month to presumably try to synthesize those things into one document. And there's hope that perhaps as soon as the middle of next month, the middle of June, they could be ready to sign a peace deal. Now, that deal would also come with, and this is the reason why the administration is involved, would also come with a minerals deal with the United States that would give the U.S. Preferential treatment when it comes to accessing Congolese mineral deposits. Rwandan mineral deposits may be included as well. That country is not nearly as mineral rich as the DRC. But Rwanda would also get some sort of a deal to be involved in the processing of those minerals and shipping them out. So it'd be able to take a piece of the pie, as it were, that would be part of this peace deal. And, really is part of the reason why Rwanda is supporting M23 so heavily. Is because it wants a hand in the mineral trade in the Eastern DRC. So the idea is to kind of give it a more legitimate role in that trade and then thereby kind of end the militant struggle. But we will see. There's certainly still a lot of moving parts that need to be ironed out before we get anywhere close to a deal.
So we're talking on VE Day, Victory in Europe Day, the 80th anniversary when the war in Europe during World War II came to an end. Putin has apparently instituted a VE Day ceasefire. So why don't you tell us about that and tell us how great it's apparently working?
He announced about 10 days ago, I think, that he was going to institute this 3-day VE Day ceasefire, which was immediately met with, questions about, why don't you just impose a longer ceasefire, or, adopt a longer ceasefire? Why are you waiting 10 days to adopt this ceasefire? Why don't you just do it right now? And he brushed those aside. The Ukrainian government has characterized this as something of a farce. Putin has, called it a test of the Ukrainian government's willingness to actually engage in peace talks. It all seems a bit manufactured to me, but Russia is celebrating VE Day, and it's an anniversary. It's a major anniversary. So he's, brought in dignitaries from around the world. I think Xi Jinping is there. Alexander Vucic, the president of Serbia. There's a number of foreign dignitaries in Moscow to participate in the celebration. And of course, there have been already accusations hours into the ceasefire from both sides. That they are violating it. The Ukrainian government said Russia has repeatedly violated it. They've been, they've been continuing to carry out attacks along the front line in Ukraine. The Russian Defense Ministry has been accusing the Ukrainians of carrying out a number of attacks along the front line and also potentially attempting another incursion into Kursk Oblast, which is a lot to get done in just a few hours after the ceasefire went into effect. But that's what the Russians are claiming. Anyway, it's going great. As you can tell, everybody's abiding by it and just loving this new break in the fighting. That it isn't really a break at all.
Let's stay in Europe, but let's go west, Derek. Let's take a train to Germany, where Merz needs a second ballot to become chancellor.
Right. The German parliament got together on Tuesday to elect a new chancellor with the leader of the Christian Democratic Union Party, Friedrich Merz, in line for that job. He had completed a coalition agreement between his party or his alliance. The Christian Democratic Union also includes the Christian Social Union in Bavaria. But the alliance of those two parties and the Social Democrats had agreed to a deal that would put Merz in the chancellor seat. What transpired was completely unexpected and indeed unprecedented in Germany's post-war history. He did not win the first vote for chancellor. This has not happened before. And given that his coalition controls 328 seats in the parliament and he only needed 316, somewhat shocking outcome. He got 310 votes on the first ballots. There were a number of holdouts from within his own party. He and his team then had to scramble to organize a very hasty second vote, which he did win. But the implication is that this is not a particularly stable coalition, that there are members of it who are not happy. And it's a secret ballot, so we don't know who, you know, don't know where the no votes came from within the coalition to try and figure out why they voted the way that they did. Nevertheless, it does point to a fairly rocky start for Meretz and potentially a rocky few years if he is even able to remain in power that long.
Let's talk about the AfD.
Germany's Federal Office for the Protection of the Constitution, or the BFV, said on Friday that it's classifying the far-right Alternative for Germany Party, or AfD, as a right-wing extremist group. That designation would open AfD up to all sorts of scrutiny from law enforcement and potentially even its dissolution as a political entity. Certainly, it would fuel calls for that. It also drew major opposition from far-right parties around the world, including the far-right Republican Party in the United States. J.D. Vance spoke out against it, I think. Marco Rubio may have said something. So the Trump administration was not pleased with this designation. AfD did very well in February's federal election. It is the main opposition party now. It finished second behind CDU-CSU, and the deal between that alliance and the Social Democrats was expressly motivated by a desire to keep AfD out of government. So, as I said, a lot of outcry from sort of the far right governments in Europe and in the United States, kind of taking over the Western world about this designation. And BFV has now suspended its classification of the party as an extremist organization. It did so on Thursday. There's not going to be any moving forward, at least for the time being, in terms of heightened surveillance or any of the things that would come with the designation as an extremist movement. It's not off the table entirely. They didn't rescind the designation or the decision or the report that said that it should be designated this way, but they are not moving forward legally with the ramifications of that yet. We'll wait and see what happens.
And now, in good news for me, talk about the EU.
I thought you'd like this one.
What is the EU trying to do?
The European Union member states, actually, I don't know, Danny, I don't know if they care about the humanities, I'm sorry to say, but the EU held a conference earlier this week in Paris called the Choose Europe for Science Conference, officials announced Ursula von der Leyen, the head of the European Commission, and other European Union commissioners announced a half a billion euro package of incentives to try to bring, they said, international academics to Europe. But the target here is really academics in the United States who are now being hounded by the federal government for being too woke or whatever. Universities are being hit for their DEI policies. They're being hit for pro-Palestinian demonstrations. They're being put under, sanctions from the government or losing, in the case of Harvard, outright losing funding. There's fear that without even getting into the ideological aspects of this, that budget cuts, DOGE and whatnot, are going to eat into funding for research in public universities, especially, which are heavily reliant on federal money, but also private universities as well. And so the European leaders are taking this opportunity. They see this as an opening to kind of lure top academics to the continent, where they insist they won't be bothered, at least, I guess, until the far right comes into power in France, too. But they'll be given more academic freedom. They'll be given funding. They'll be given all the things that they were getting in the U.S. and are no longer getting, or at least fear might be taken away. This is their move to poach U.S. academics, especially in the sciences. They're von der Leyen
seems primarily in the sciences, Derek.
Yeah, I mean, I would think, maybe some engineering as well. But, I'm sorry to say, I don't know that the history field is going to benefit from this too much. But von der Leyen wants EU member states to be investing 3% of their gross domestic product in research and development by 2030, which if you tack that on to the 5% they're now supposed to be investing in military spending, there's some heavy demands being made of these countries. But this one is potentially, you know, something that could work to the long-term benefit of European states if it comes about.
Thanks, Derek. And let's conclude on this space thing, which is that the United States is trying to push countries to adopt Starlink.
Yeah, the Washington Post reported on this. A friend of the show, Jeff Stein, and Hannah Nathanson reported on this yesterday. Basically, as part of these tariff negotiations or trade negotiations that are supposed to be going on with, for example, the UK, which, you know, apparently they've got a deal there. But there's supposedly negotiations going on, you know, with several other countries. They apparently are pushing heavily for the countries that are engaged in these talks. And the article mentions Lesotho. It mentions Somalia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, Bangladesh, Pakistan, Vietnam. So a number of states that have been hit with very high tariffs. Lesotho had, you know, the highest of any of the countries that got hit with Trump's reciprocal tariffs, 50% for such an impoverished country. All of these countries seem to be amenable, at least, to doing deals with Starlink for their internet service. And that's what the Trump administration is kind of prodding them to do. Ostensibly, the rationale here is that Starlink is not a Chinese company. So this is part of the new Cold War competition. And the U.S. wants to keep, you know, these countries from getting becoming dependent on Chinese internet suppliers. But, you know, let's be real here. Musk bankrolled Donald Trump's campaign. He's running the office of the Department of Government Efficiency and making himself a very strong presence inside the administration. This smacks of some major, I think, corruption to kind of steer these countries onto his own company to provide their internet service. This seems pretty shady to me.
I don't know, Derek. I think it's all above board. Anyway, thank you everyone. Thank you everyone for listening. As always, keep on rocking in the free world, but please stay on. We've invited friend of the show, Josh Olson, and his co-host T, to talk about their new podcast that I was on this week, called White Cannon. I was on it to talk about Saving Private Ryan, so you can check that out and listen to us talk a little bit about the show. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world. Bye. Hey gang, Danny here, back as always with Derek, and we're very excited to welcome first back to the podcast, Josh Olson, famed screenwriter and podcast guru, excellent podcaster, podcast god, as well as to the first time to the podcast, Trevor Beaulieu, and we're here to talk about their new podcast called White Cannon. I was on it this week talking about Saving Private Ryan, so if you haven't checked that out, please check it out. I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's a really cool podcast. I had a really fun time doing it, and it's a really cool idea, this notion of White Cannon, so I could explain it, but why don't I throw it to you guys? Where did the idea for the podcast come from? What are you trying to do with it?
Yeah, so the idea for the podcast, I'd always had this thought that I had about how people would tell me about a movie that was really iconic to them, and I would just be like, I haven't heard of that movie, or I just wouldn't get it. It might be a movie I saw and I just didn't see the big deal, and white people would always be taken aback. Because there's always this assumption, I guess, that
everybody loves that movie.
Yeah. That white culture is just basically culture, you know, and something like, say, you know, Tyler Perry or something that's like, you know, black culture is a niche. And, you know, I mean, it makes sense. As a majority, you don't think of your own culture as being foreign to somebody. You know, it's just the default normative culture. So I thought, you know, that'd be an interesting podcast to do. So I posted on Twitter, like half jokingly, that I wanted to make a podcast where that happened instead of. I remember exactly what started it. It was I was watching these BuzzFeed things where they have white people discover a show like Martin or something, and they would just be like, "Oh my god, this thing is amazing!" And I it would just kind of annoy me, that they were just treated like this weird artifact or this weird curio. And I was thinking, like, you know, a lot of your shows to us are very bizarre and we don't get them either. And I would think it'd be nice to see some, like, kind of turnabout. And I posted it on Twitter kind of half jokingly, and people really, really liked it. And the post went viral and people could be giving ideas and all this stuff. And I started thinking, you know what, maybe it's actually something here. So I started doing it as a segment on my main podcast, which is Champagne Sharks, and they'd be like among the most popular episodes. But labor-wise, they were a logistical nightmare to set up. And also, I just felt like I didn't know enough white people who I thought were both incisive and funny to, you know, be the white guest on the show. I knew people who were, like, you know, pretty smart, but I didn't think they'd be very interesting to talk to. You know, with podcasting, not just about how smart you are. You have to have a little bit of entertainment value to yourself. And then also, there'd be some people who I thought were very entertaining, but I did not like the taste in movies. So Josh, who was one of the first guests when we did it on Champagne Sharks, really seemed to enjoy his experience there. He kept talking about it and asking when it was coming back, and then volunteered to help do it. So we ended up doing it as a whole new podcast, which I think worked out for the better.
Yeah, it was such a great time. I went on and did Network with Matt Crispin, was the other white guy. And it was so much fun. And yeah, and then Trevor told me, I said, why aren't you doing more? And he said, I don't know enough white people. And I said, well, I can probably handle that. So, yeah, we found some other white people. The thing that's funny to me as we go, it's been really fun. As you know, Danny, you've come on, and Derek, you'll have to come on. We'll have to come up with one for you. It's funny because there's this kind of quality to the concept where, in fact, just in the past 24 hours, I had somebody who I was reaching out to be a guest who will be on soon. When I just told them the white canon, went, oh, you mean like falling down? And I'm like, no, that's the white supremacist canon. This is all, we're not, and I realized, like, it's, some people think it's just like, we're just going to take movies that white people love and then take 2 hours and explain to you how racist they are. And that's not what we're doing.
That's a good question, though. Is white is a falling down white canon?
Well, yeah, we will definitely discuss.
I would say yes, personally, yeah.
But it's also too easy, kind of. And then the other one, which was hilarious, is the other day I made the mistake of, I guess, exposing my horrible misogyny and racism and said something about Kamala Harris over on Blue Sky. And immediately set off this flurry of, like, look at this, like, you know, cis hetero racist white man going after blah, blah, blah. And then in the replies, my favorite was somebody went, oh, my God, I just found out he has a podcast where he explains movies to black people.
Oh, my God. That's great.
The show is happily neither of those things. but what it is a little harder to find. You're constantly going, like, what is white canon? What counts, you know? And we've had some really great conversations with folks. We did The Graduate. We've done some John Hughes stuff. Those are the ones that have come out. I don't know, T, are we going to reveal some of the ones that are coming up, or should we just sort of...
Yeah, we can reveal some of the ones that are coming up, but I'm just stuck on the idea of explaining movies to black people. Like, that might not be a bad idea.
Like how they work? Like that you're, you know, like... What does that even mean?
I don't know. Like,
you see, you get some people and they pretend to be other people and you film them and that's how...
It's all made up. It's like a reality show, except it's fake.
It's not really happening.
I want to know, like, the person look at what the show was about and somehow misconstrue it, or they just willfully lie based on the title. Like, I always wonder, like, how do, like, lies like that happen? Like, is this... It's such a crazy lie. I love it. Yes, yeah, so some of the ones coming up. Yeah, I think we can.
Well, I think we should keep the black canon one secret because we did flip it at one point, and we have a great guest who comes on, and We talk about a movie that is sort of widely known and beloved by Black audiences that not so much folks who look like me and that I had never seen. That was fun. But we've got like Dazed and Confused coming up. We did a double feature of Ordinary People and American Beauty. We did Casablanca. So it's fun. And sometimes there are movies that we all love, and sometimes there are movies that we don't all love. And sometimes it's movies that we all have a complicated relationship with. Our first episode, we did a John Hughes double feature, and we did Wyatt Cenac, who had only seen one of the films. And then my good friend Dan Waters, who wrote Heathers, who's got a, you know, which is as a movie is a very, very sort of like punk rock response to John Hughes. But Dan also kind of loves those movies. So his relationship is very complicated. And that was fun. So it's like the idea is to kind of figure out to some extent, what is white canon? What does that mean? And then to kind of look at movies that, you know, I would say the three of us in this conversation kind of take for granted that everybody knows and loves, and then sort of discuss what that means. What is it to be the dominant culture? And what is it to be, you know, to have to live in that culture and deal with the assumptions people make about what you know and what you care about.
I think a lot of people assume it's going to be a scolding type of podcast where you just bring a white person on and like flagellate them. Yeah, so.
Yeah, although we should do that just once, you know.
It is not a BDSM theme.
Like if we could find, in fact, if we do Falling Down, let's find someone who just loves that movie down to their toes, and then we can berate them for 2 hours. But I don't think that's a particularly that doesn't feel like a long running show to me.
Yeah, I mean, I was on it, and I just thought it was a really interesting way to approach this notion, because the idea of a canon is also really interesting, and as you continue to type a kind of go back into history, I'm sure you'll also see how notions of whiteness have changed over time. And I think it's a really interesting thing to explore through this premise of a canon that is a canon for white people, but not for Black Americans. It's a really clever idea, and it was really fun, and it's not scoldy at all. It's just like a way to talk about movies.
It's also going to expand beyond Black people. Like, we plan to just incorporate other groups as well, and also like things with gender also. So it's not just going to be no pun intended, Black and white. It's gonna have a lot of, like, for example, I want to do one on the Joy Luck Club. I think we're talking about that one. That one, I think, would be a very interesting one with Asian guests and see how that goes. Yeah. Things like that.
And Something Like It Hot is one we've talked about doing endlessly, because I'm fascinated with how that movie, being, you know, 6,000 years old, manages to get so many gender issue things right that people in Hollywood in 2025 don't even seem to understand.
All those underground commies were still writing for the business.
That the people who remade it didn't understand. I don't know if I ever told you about the Broadway musical version, but that one is actually an attempt to try to like woke wash it. They actually make it more regressive. It's amazing.
As oftentimes happens. So guys, I gotta go, but we're gonna have a link in the show notes, so everyone check that out. And
please do.
Where could they find you? Where could they find the show? Leave our listeners with whatever they need to know about how to get access to the white canon.
Well, the most important thing, you can find me and T all over the place. We're social media and stuff like that. But the important thing is, it's canon, C-A-N-O-N, and it's wherever good podcasts are found. You can find it on Apple, Spotify, all that stuff. But it's The White Canon with Trevor and Josh. And just if you spell canon right, you'll be fine. And that's probably a major flaw, isn't it? Having a title whose spelling you have to explain.
Well, when you Google the title, it shows the Canon camera.
It happens
Canon
all the time.
Camera, that's white. Yeah, when you Google white canon, that's what comes up.
I wonder if you Google white canon with two N's, what do you get? Like some piece of artillery, I guess. <Yeah. laughs>
nothing good, that's for fucking sure. All right, guys, thank you so much for joining us. Everyone, check out the show.
Yeah, thank you.
And thanks everyone for listening. Bye.
Take care.
Yes.